Techie Talk time, folks. State Representative Techie Chan Quincy is joining us once again on a Tuesday, Techie, for a change.
Yeah, we're doing a two consecutive Tuesdays. We actually make this bit of a pattern for Tuesdays and tacky at home. The schedule for Wednesday and Thursday at the State House really has become office-packed meeting days. If we can squeeze you in between meetings at the State House, obviously we will, as we've done in the past, but this could be a new trend for a while until they decide Tuesday, meaning my staff, decides Tuesday would be office meeting days, and we'll probably try to do Thursdays back at home. I don't know.
We'll have to change the name to Tacky Talk Tuesdays.
Perhaps, yes. As you all can hear, I have some control of my schedule, but not entirely controlled. And obviously, if there's family emergencies, I can, shuffle stuff around. We do try to accommodate people the best we can on meetings. And some days it is true. It is really packed out. And sadly, even though we do a virtual show, we're not able to squeeze you in somewhere during the day of packed meetings.
Only so many hours in the day, exactly. So we got to make it work best we can.
Well, when we close session, we close formal sessions on August 1st, you can have me for the rest of the year, Joe.
Woohoo! We can do a tacky talk every day. Maybe not.
Maybe not. No, I think that'd be a little too much tacky for anyone.
How'd St. Patrick's Day go? Were you tacky O'Chan?
Well, everyone's Irish one day, as we know in Massachusetts. And actually, to be honest, I was out getting signatures. We're hitting some friends' homes around my district and find out who's home, texting folks. And I decided to see if we're going to start with what I refer to as I know you're a voter and you're a good signature approach first. And then keep moving along. And I'm pretty sure I'm going to have everything done in the next few weeks. It's amazing when you go through your contact list, you realize you have a lot more friends than you thought you did.
Yeah, that process is a mystery to folks, I think. But you actually look, you know who votes, right? We don't know how they vote, but you know who votes and who doesn't.
Essentially, yes. I mean, we do get information from the city clerk's office. City clerk provides the information to Secretary of State's Central Voter Database. And the Central Voter Database at the Secretary's office from all the city and town clerks will take out anyone who's passed away or you've been an inactive voter. And it's a bit of a moving target on that one. It's the general rule is that if you've been an inactive voter for 7 or more years, you are removed from the voter rolls and have to re-register to vote. Sometimes a little less than 7 years. That's why I see a little bit of moving target because one time the Secretary of State had the clerks purge their records of inactive voters to less than 7 years. So as a result, many of us buy voter databases or constituent databases. I buy a constituent database, Community Fluency, that I use to log constituent calls. So when you call or email me, we look you up somewhere in Quincy because I do buy the whole city, not just my part of the city. And we log you into the system regarding your constituent concern or your concern about a bill. If it's email, it's great. We just cut and paste your email so we can read it verbatim. Obviously, it's not my constituent in the city. We send it to Bruce or we send it to Ron. If you're outside our district, we try to find your rep because we can use MA. I'm sorry, what is it called? Where do I vote MA.com? Where do I vote MA.com? You can look up outside Quincy, your the representative, and then we just ship that email off to that appropriate office. And then, for my purposes, obviously, we don't know who you vote for, but we do know your voting record in terms of showing up to vote. You could send in a blank ballot, you could send in a write-in, you can vote for whomever, but we have a record of who votes. And obviously, this is a job where you make some friends along the way, and we hit door to door or people we know to get their good signatures on our nomination papers. I generally work on assumptions. I say this over and over again. I work on the assumption you have a 20% death rate of the signatures you get because of an ineligibility, wrong political party, moved, whatever reasons. So in my case, as a Democrat, I can get anyone that's a Democrat or unenrolled voter in my district to sign my nomination papers. So as you can tell, earlier statement, I'm looking for a guaranteed signatures first. They know there's no question marks. And that way I don't have to worry about my 20% error margin of error. So papers have to be to city clerk's office by April 30th. And I believe it has to be all in before Memorial Day at the Secretary of State's office. And you also have to file your financial disclosures. This is something that people don't realize. They have to file a financial disclosure with the State Ethics Commission every year. It is a prerequisite for running for office. You have to truthfully, under pains and perjury, tell the public in general terms, where your money's from.
I didn't realize you had to pay for the voting list. Who do you buy them from? How much do they cost?
Well, the secretary's office can give it to you. I'm sorry, the city clerk's office can give it to you for free or nominal cost. Particularly now that it's on Excel spreadsheets, you can do that. But you can use Vote Builder, Community Fluency. I'm sure there's other companies like Salesforce is another company that is a international company really that does different types of voter slash constituent databases. It's about $1,200 a year for me anyway to do a constituent database. And Vote Builder is actually more designed for campaigning, which means that you use your cell phone. There's different logging systems. But I like to keep track, as you all hear over and over again. I get your email, we log into the system. That's community fluency for us. So $1,200 a year, which is actually not bad price. And then if I want add-ons regarding extra data or extra features, I'll pay for the add-ons and they'll quote me a price depending what it is. Other folks use Vote Builder. I know Senator Brownsberger created his own database from scratch. In the old days, we used to just have like binders and binders of paper. And then you fill out a constituent response form or constituent login form intake on paper. You handwrite the whole thing and then you put it in a binder. And then you have some type of indexing and then you kind of comb through the binder to find out, if Tacky Chan had called in the past and what he called about. Thanks to computers and cloud computing and all that, we're able to much more easily identify you. And thanks to the information from cities and town clerks to the Secretary Central Voter Registered Voter Database, these database systems can go to the Secretary of State's office and download new data periodically. So they do it, every 6 to 12 months. If you're in an urgent situation, I can collect the data myself from the city clerk's office and just, email it over to the constituent database folks and let them do a more frequent update. So, there's some little kinks in the system that I need to talk to them about that I wasn't sure how some of these things work, which is not your problem. But it's also nice because there's a company that enjoys feedback from the customers. So the company likes to hear from us, like, hey, what works, what doesn't work, and then they'll take those calls and try to see if they can improve their system.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't realize that was how the process worked. How many signatures do you need?
For a rep, you'll need 150 certified signatures from the city clerk's office, keyword certified. So you got to make sure that the clerk's office stamps each paper, and then you count the number of signatures correctly before you submit to Secretary of State. Secretary's office will review the signatures a second time. If there's anything wrong with a signature, obviously Secretary of State's office has the ability to remove them.
Absolutely. Yep. Want to make sure they're accurate.
Make sure they're accurate. And we do still have signature forms in clerk's offices. So whether it be a PDF or still in paper, depending, via the town or city clerk, if you when you sign your form to register to vote, those signatures are put on the record. And we don't know if there's always, some discrepancies. This isn't like you're 100% signature every time. I mean, it's got to be realm of reasonableness with the clerk's determination that this is the actual signature the person has signed. I mean, we all
Gotcha.
know, you've all signed papers. Nobody signs it like 100% perfectly every single time.
Right. No, absolutely. My signature certainly changed a lot over the years. It looks nothing like it did even 10 years ago,
But then,
today.
it could be a problem because it has to reflect the signature in the clerk's office.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Yeah.
So this you could be a disputed signature.
For the first time this past primary election, when I voted, they now use these poll pads, these electronic devices, and they just scan my driver's license in, and boom, all the information came up right there.
Yeah, I didn't. We have the pads in Quincy too. It was the first time I saw it in November election, and now in the presidential primary. I think the November election was a little bit more trying to figure out how it works, but much more smoother than the presidential primary. It's a just speed. If you can scan your ID and it matches in the database, you can just do and go. Obviously, a driver's license renewed every 5 years, so it can also be used as an ID to give your address if you move. We're not asking you to get a new driver's license every time you move. We should get a new driver's license, but it's not on people's high priority list, I'll be frank with you.
Oh yeah, no, not at all. You just, sign the little thing on the back of the license there, and that's it.
Yeah, people don't think about that, right? I move a new license, but it's 5 years. It's like checking accounts. You should get new checks too, because the address and the check changes, even though no one's not going to cash that check. So, those who may remember, you go down to vote. You have to like go into a book. They have to find your name, add street name, number of street, then your name. That's always been the sequence. And they check you off. And then when you exit voting, meaning you voted, you want to put your ballot in the box, you have to do it at the same thing again. This electronic method, over time, as the poll workers get more used to it, should expedite the process, because you think about it, you can swipe or you can just type in the first like four letters of Meadowbrook, for example, MEADOW, MEEAD, just those four letters should bring up a very short list of streets in Quincy of those first four letters. And they can just kind of like tap your way really fast through the list, and then you can log yourself in. So this should create more efficiency on moving it down, because even when they had it on paper and they check your name next to the box, somebody has the data entry, that information, at the clerk's office.
Right, so it's an extra step, yeah.
Yeah, so there's an extra step where all those books are collected and they take it to the city, a clerk's office. Someone's going to punch all that data in of the voters. And so you can imagine, in the presidential cycle in November, where we get about 50,000, potentially 50,000 people at the top end, voting out of what's the registered voters? Say about 67,000.
Yeah, it's about right in Quincy. Yeah.
So about 40, 45,000, voters in November come out, generally about 60% turnout. So you could collect all those books, and then someone at City Hall, in the clerk's office, has to data entry all that stuff in.
Right. Yeah, that's very time consuming and tedious, I'm sure, for that person.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't know what the system have at City Hall. I can ask Nikki, but I'm sure somebody's, eyes are glazing over, just going through every single book. So this electronic system will greatly save time in the clerk's office.
Yeah.
Someone sitting there for like, I don't know how long it takes, but you put in like 50,000 or 40,000 data entries.
It's gonna be a while. Yeah, it's gonna take a little while for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the basic process. I mean, we're doing this now, and other candidates, state senator, the county officials that are up, as well as Senator Warren and Congressman Lynch, and are currently collecting these issues.
Yep. Any more announcements in the legislature of people moving on?
No, it's quiet beginning of the week on that. We may be hearing some news towards the end of the week. But right now, it's been fairly quiet start to the conversation on anyone else moving on. There's still plenty of time, as you can imagine. There's still about 6 weeks to get your papers into the town or city clerk's offices. So someone announces they're leaving at the end of March, still plenty of time for candidates to get the papers and run for the open seat. So
Sure.
that's why I say this, anything still happen right now.
Yep. Was there another supplemental budget introduced by the governor this week, Tacky?
I don't know.
Okay.
I've not seen a news feed telling me it's happened yet. Perhaps, but
Okay.
I'm not aware yet. We still are sitting on a supplemental budget in Ways and Means.
Right.
We can use the vehicle of administration, finance, secretariat, calls Ways and Means, say, look, this is where in our bills, here we go. There, Senate did debate so-called migrant funding issue of using ARPA money in the Senate last week. And hopefully we'll reach a resolution before the month is over.
Yeah, I know it's getting to be a critical issue for sure. It's going to be a long-term issue, I think, in the state too, unless the Fed steps up.
Well, where they're going to go? I mean, there obviously be folks just like any other person in Massachusetts who are going to move on to find better opportunities, or find friends or family in other places, better support networks. It's a constantly moving state. I mean, the United States has freedom of movement between states. None of us have to actually show passports identification to enter a different state. So, like everybody else, I expect, people to be moving around depending on, opportunities are available somewhere else. But agreed, this is going to be a permanent part of our state in terms of new residents at some level. Just like the refugees that have come before, because we still are placing Afghans, we're still placing Ukrainians, we're still placing Haitians. We have Bhutanese that we're placing still, that I found out a few days ago. So, there's a lot more than just the what you see in the news regarding folks that are legally here, trying to figure out how to make it a life of different types of refugee, migrant, immigration, asylum seeker statuses in Massachusetts. And we already had several thousand refugees prior to the migrant crisis we have now. So, people are under some incorrect perception that there was not an influx. There was already influx before the situation and migrants started.
Yeah, it's something that just because of the surge, I guess, all at once that overwhelmed the system.
That's right. The volume. They came in unexpectedly without an intermediate not-for-profit agency that helps them out on refugees on getting started in a new life, so to speak. Wasn't available here. They just showed up, and that's kind of part of the challenge that we face. We just don't know. And even in the refugees situation, where the federal government's working through various refugee organizations nationally. It's not like we get a lot of advance notice either. They just show up, and we're constantly pivoting as these new residents come because it impacts your school systems, the healthcare systems at a local level, and obviously look up to the state for financial assistance, on this new influx. Quincy, again, has been very fortunate. We've had refugees come to Quincy prior to the migrant issue, but I'm pretty confident nobody really noticed or felt the impact because it was not like 15,000 people now, right? But they are here, and the state provides some funding over the last couple of years for transition, and we've been providing funding for new kids in school systems. So the people in Quincy are under the perception that there are no refugees or asylum seekers or other migrants that are legally here. No, they're here. We just the slower pace of arrival means that you just never noticed.
I know we like to talk about the economy on this program a lot, and with the Fed's gonna be meeting this week, talking about interest rates.
Yeah, Chairman Powell is the man of the day for the last 4 years, the Federal Reserve Chairman. No one even knew what the Federal Reserve was until COVID hit, and they had to do some very dramatic and drastic and unheard of financial somersaults to try to ensure that the economy doesn't fall into the Great Depression scenario, which is why the Federal Reserve was actually created. It was created out of post-Great Recession in its current format to try to get ahead, well, they can't really get ahead, but to mitigate after they find out there's a problem. And that's why the stock exchange has stopped trading post Great Depression. But believe it or not, it was the biggest corporations in the world got together, was talking to Congress, trying to figure out, how do we stop the stock market from completely bottom out? How do we ensure that the banks aren't making their independent rates everywhere on their own? Arbitrarily, as and yeah, there was no internet yet. Telephones were still nascent. They were still using telegraph machines. I mean, they're trying to figure out how to, address these issues. And, the Federal Reserve banks always existed, but the current job is what it is to keep inflation down and, maximum job growth. And the maximum job growth actually was created during the 70s in the last huge inflationary period. That part of that job was added on to them. So they have two mandates, as we hear in the news. So, the interest rates have stayed stable between 5 and 5.25%. And the question is, the mystery question is the Fed's going to lower rates in 2024 and when they're going to do it? So I'm going to expect that Chairman Powell is going to be somewhat opaque about this. I'd be very surprised if he's going to name a date given the data dependency. And you generally lower rates when the economy is going downward spiral. And We have still a very strong economy. So I'm not expecting a lot out of Chairman Powell tomorrow. I do think that the pundits and the economists are going to try to read between the lines, every single word he uses to try to guesstimate. And then, of course, a month later, the Federal Reserve monthly minutes come out for the last meeting. And then we have called the dot points, right? The vote of each member regarding where they think interest rates should be. And kind of clues people in about what the future may hold, but they don't, they don't name like it's going to start this month.
Right. Yeah, no, everything that I've read so far is he's going to hold the line because, unemployment is still low. And like you say, the economy is chugging along pretty strongly.
Yeah, layoffs have largely occurred in the tech industry. Some little bit of financial, but you see a lot of layoffs in the big tech industry, meaning the highest end of the wage earners tend to get laid off right now as part of restructuring. A lot of it's, I won't say a lot of it, but part of it is COVID related. It had to gear up because we all went to a digital economy for a while, essentially, like we're talking on Zoom here, right? But as you heard, I have more in-person meetings. So then, things like this meeting we're here and Zoom has less demands, which means you change your workforce regarding the customer need. And if the customers don't need as much, then you change the size of your workforce because that's what creates the job. If customers don't need you, then you have less people working.
That's
Just
business, folks. Yeah.
it is business. Less customers equals less workers. And again, we're a consumer economy, right? So, but it hasn't really, permeated to large scale layoffs at the Main Street level. I mean, it isn't like you're seeing your local businesses doing a lot of laying off. The migration of workers continue. That's not a layoff. If you leave your job for a better job somewhere else, that's not a layoff. That's a migration. So they're migrating between better opportunities, better pay, which means they never show up at unemployment. There may be, a short period between jobs. Let's say you want to take a 5-day break between one job to another. That's not a layoff situation. You're not part of the statistics. You're just kind of, doing a transition. So, it's local business still hiring. Some have gotten more efficient or was able to make things happen with less workers. And I think that's what's happening right now is that small businesses or mid-sized businesses are figuring out still how to, and probably have figured out some of them, how to, maximize their current workforce without adding new folks. And, obviously, they have a higher price structure. We talk about this all the time. Everyone's still paying more. It doesn't matter where the grocery store or the restaurant or buying sneakers. I mean, that's still part of it. So, you're right. Strong economy, the interest rate reduction is designed to stimulate a poor economy or declining economy. Well, it's still going strong. And we're hitting summertime. Summertime is a big service economy. I know it's March, but in this part of the world, the Boston Marathon starts the summer economy.
That's right. Yeah.
And outside money is, in many ways, great because it's not our money circulating in the economy, it's somebody else's money circulating in our economy. And they're gonna, low infrastructure. They come in, they use our services and goods, and they move on back home as part of the vacation. And we have graduation season in May. And then you got the start of summer. Not just people coming to Massachusetts from around the world, but also we will leave Massachusetts going around the world during summer break. So, we'll see how the summer economy moves, right? We watch Cape Cod, we watch Boston, we watch, the influx of graduating students in other college towns. And the airlines and Expedia and Bookings.com and all those guys have data information about, how many people come to Massachusetts and the Mass Office of Tourism and Trade. Is going to have to figure out, what the projections are going to be. And it's tourism is number two or three of our biggest economic drivers, depending on the year. It's always healthcare, biotech, education, health, tourism. Then we have seafood and complex machineries.
Interesting. So that's the Massachusetts economy in a nutshell.
Those are the big five. Amazingly, they haven't changed in a very long time. It's still those big five things. We do actually have an agricultural slash seafood industry, and it is part of our economic system. Those of us in Greater Boston never think about it. But once you get, Worcester West, North, agricultural economy is a big part of it, especially organic farming and of course seafood, we're a coastal community. And for New England, a lot of the seafood passes through New Bedford, Fall River. They also pass through Boston for the purposes of shipping it overseas.
Sure. And here in Quincy, next year be the 400th anniversary. So I'm sure the city's hoping for an influx right here in Quincy.
Oh, absolutely. The fact that we have two presidents here, it's a historical city. It's very old city. We always point out that the Great Hall, the State House, that the flags in the Great Hall for municipalities is based on age. The newest ones at the top of the state of the Great Hall are those flags. The lowest rungs are the ones that are the most oldest incorporation. So, yeah, we won't talk about Braintree.
Yes, we know it was Braintree first.
Yeah, we don't talk about Braintree. Those of us who live locally here understand this inside issue, kind of a joke and a rivalry. Those of us who live outside of Quincy have no idea what we're talking about.
That's true, and that's okay. They can look it up if they really want, if they really want to learn about it. I've been reading with interest this whole discussion about bringing pensions back and doing one with 401ks. What do you think about that, Jackie?
Well, the death of the pension system is actually making it more difficult for people to retire because it's basically a fixed steady income for people to know what the baseline retirement opportunity is. As we talk about the markets around here, it's hard. It isn't like people can pivot quickly, like hedge fund managers can, whose day job is to keep an eye on the market and take care of other people's money. Obviously, in the pension system, we have PERAC and PRIM and State Retirement Board, and we have a lot of auditing of our pension fund at the state level. And the expectation is they want to keep the fund ability to pay pensions. Private sector pensions have really been dying off for a very long time, and partially it's because of the death of corporations. Kodak is one of the best examples where when they went bankrupt, the Fed laws didn't protect the pensions as part of bankruptcy. And a lot of pensioners were put in a very bad situation when Kodak went under. And when pensions were invented, no one thought that their, staple corporation may not exist.
Right. Yeah, so it was the whole switch over from manufacturing to service industry, I think, was part of that.
Yeah, GE is an example of a company that still has a pension system, but that involves having GE to continue to exist. If GE and other big corporations, decided the pension system, isn't going to work as it is now, they got to think about how to spin it off as a, quasi-independent entity to ensure the pensioners don't lose their money. But often don't think of that. And the feds have always put a lot of more guardrails and safeties on that because, like 70 years ago, there was nothing keeping a corporation from dipping into your pension fund to pay its bills as a short-term loan. I mean, that's what Social Security does now. Social Security has been dipped into. People don't realize the federal government dipped into your Social Security a long time ago in an IOU. And this is something the public doesn't realize. The feds, before the 80s in particular, just used it as like a loan because the birth rate was so high and there's such a high workforce. Social Security is such flesh and cash that the feds decided it was cheaper to just borrow against the Social Security fund and put an IOU down, which then creates a liability. And guess what? That happens in state governments too. State government before the 80s were actively using the pension fund as a easy loan opportunity as opposed to actually going to the bond market. And that helps contribute to the liability, the pension fund liability, Social Security liabilities. Private corporations a long time ago were doing the same thing. That only hurts pensioners because you pay into the pension. So another reason pensions went out, I truly believe this is to basically help private wealth management companies.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, the argument you may have heard before in Washington, D.C. is eliminate Social Security, give everyone back the money and let them figure it out with wealth management fund managers, basically make Fidelity rich. That's not smart. Because the market's volatile and Social Security at least gives you a baseline safety net. So when you retire, even though it may not be a ton of money, but you know what the number is.
It's a guaranteed number, right?
Yeah, and then there's a COLA adjustment based on inflation, which people have seen, but Medicare is expensive. MassHealth is what we call it, but it's Medicare for seniors is what it is. People could keep thinking MassHealth isn't Medicare. It's the same thing. It's state managed. And as a result, Those costs goes up, the cola gets chewed out by the Social Security. That's what happened to my mom. She had a substantial cola of over 8%, I believe. And then Medicare came in. I'm looking at her tax records like, oh, well, that got chewed up. This kind of problem with the feds. They need to figure out how to make this that your cola actually is a cola, not chewed up by healthcare.
Right, and otherwise you just stay status quo. You never go up.
Yeah, but as I repeat again, don't depend on Social Security as a social safety net. I mean, you have 401ks at your private employer. If they match, definitely take the match as much as you can. If you're not for profits, 403b, again, if there's a match, take it as you can. If you're a government employer like me, it's 457, and there is no match. You cannot match. The government does not match. So I'm kind of on my own, making contributions. And then you got your IRA, which a lot of folks use, that is tax deferred. You got the Roth IRA, which is post-tax, which means that you can put money in your Roth IRA. When you take it out, there's no tax on it because you already paid your taxes before you might put your money in your Roth. So, there's plenty of opportunities. Plus, you can have your own little portfolio, or you can have CDs or bonds, which is still good right now, to make a little extra interest income. And of course, you can have equity in property. You have a home, you have some equity. If you don't have a home, ownership, obviously, you're much more cash dependent on your investments. But, how many of us have time to sit there and watch our portfolio on our various opportunities and retirement accounts nonstop and constantly make adjustments? I mean, this is the problem I was had with particularly Republicans who in DC says, oh, give them back their money. It's basically making Fidelity and other wealth fund managers rich because they charge you fees.
Right. Yeah, that's and most people just don't know how to manage their money, especially in the stock market.
Yeah, it's intimidating. I mean, people have busy lives. You all have busy lives. I mean, you see the market up, got down, you see the market down, but what does that really mean to most of us in terms of our retirement? Most of us want, low cost fee mutual funds or index funds in our retirement portfolios and 401ks and IRAs, and then you ride it for the long term. But I always believe that you should set aside a small amount of money, no matter what your age, into a retirement account. And watch it compound and grow over the course of your life. And you can put a little more, you can. If you can't put as much that year, then you don't. But
Right.
people should always put aside a little bit of money, no matter what your age, into a retirement account and just let it compound.
Yeah, I've heard it explained as this, kind of a three-legged stool to your retirement. There's Social Security, there's your 401ks and IRAs, and then there's your own personal savings, cash essentially.
Essentially, yes, or assets. So if you have a lot of money in equity, meaning your property, and you're property rich, but you could be cash poor. And I know that home sales are expensive, and even if you sell your home, you got to find a cheaper home, which is hard because the property values are so pricey. That's the consequence of having high property value. It's not just you, it's everyone around you has high property value. But if you hit a certain age and you decide warmer climates a better place to go, not surprising, warmer climates have lower tax rates and lower property values, although I think that's going to change really quickly. I think Florida is getting out of control. And Arizona's gotten out of control. And New Mexico's got it out of control, relatively speaking, because you have all these folks, from wealthier states and deciding they want to have a lower cost of living, at a certain age and warm climates. And because people move into those areas that used to be much more affordable, and property has shifted because of the demand. And they can't build homes fast enough in places like New Mexico and Arizona and Nevada, and even Colorado, and Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina has been a popular place for people to try to settle down. South Carolina, certain parts of South Carolina, but I mean, again, every time someone from Massachusetts moves down south, the property value is going to change.
It's going to definitely drive costs up there too as well. It's it's people don't think about it, but this is a big country, and a lot of it is unpopulated still, even after all these many years of the country being founded.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the vast majority of population centers tend to be on coastlines. They tend to be in high urban centers with economic development or there's a state capital. People forget there's a massive desert, there's two mountain ranges, and of course, there's farmland. We need farmland. It's kind of self-explanatory. But the majority of people live along the coastlines or major cities where there's large economic centers. I mean, it's not hard to do. You just go to any Google map of the night sky and you can see the bright lights around the
Okay.
country. And the more lighting generally means that there's more people living in that location. So you pick, like, you Google map like 9 p.m. night sky, in the United States, you can kind of see the whole population centers.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the country is still evolving. It's still growing. I mean, compared to the rest of the world, right? We're just the babies.
Oh yeah, this is still a very young country in terms of its age, but we're one of the oldest continuously stable countries and democracies in the world. I mean, it's 17, but people have about 1776 independence, but it's really, in the 1780s is when the U.S. Constitution was ratified over several years that created the U.S. government. So, it's a young country, but a very old government, comparatively speaking, to the rest of the world. I mean, after World War II, a lot of governments, really moved towards the democratic states away from monarchies, particularly after World War II. And the end of colonization created new governments where European colonists, in particular, imperialism ended. And as a result, new governments had to be formed. So some governments are less than 50 years old. And some were military dictatorships right into the 80s. And some are still military dictatorships.
Yes, for sure. Yeah,
So,
not that far either. Cuba is not that far away.
Oh, yes. And some were falling backwards. I mean, parts of Africa, parts of South America too, and parts of Southeast Asia. So, as President talks about this kind of big picture about freedom and democracies, what he's trying to get at is that, we spent a lot of time moving the world towards democracies against the Soviet Union, who was moving towards autocracies. And now we're back in that situation during the Cold War, for those of us old enough to know what the Cold War is that now we're back in the same position of a battle between autocratic systems versus democratic systems. And, we're back in this kind of Cold War situation of proxy wars, right? In some way, Ukraine's a proxy war, right? The situation in the Middle East is kind of an odd proxy war too of Hamas, Israel. It's not just a security issue, but Israel is a democracy in a area that doesn't have democracies. Right, put aside the whole fighting for the survival and the tragedies and in the Gaza Strip and 1,200 dead Israelis, and I mean, it's just the whole thing is just a human tragedy on like a lot of levels. But at the same time, the one bastion democracy is Israel in the Middle East. So it is the interesting thing about how that operates, even though you have some like Lebanon has a democracy, but is it really, right? With Hezbollah basically telling people what to do, and then, even though you have elections in the West Bank, they still don't have a prime minister. The thing's kind of dysfunctional. So, this is a little bit on a global, philosophical, political level. We've been working so hard as a country and other allies to try to create more democracies, no matter what they look like. If autocracy is the way to go and military dictators are back in play, and population centers around the world no longer looks at the United States as an opportunity and a model for democracy and freedom, it's going to devolve back to military dictatorships. And let's call it what it is, folks. It's a military dictatorship. I mean, that's what President Putin is. He's a military dictator in the end. And President Xi is an controlled economy. Controls their economy, major military power now. And the way their democratic structure set up is not a democratic structure in the way we understand it. And essentially, it's a military dictator. He is the sole commander of that army as well. So then you got two major nuclear powers that are really run by dictatorships, but you have India and Pakistan, very interesting and complicated situation, particularly in Pakistan. Who have parliamentary governments and all the challenges associated with those parliamentary governments.
Yeah, it's yeah. I mean, you could take whole college classes on this issue for sure, and just studying it over the years, to see how it's evolved and where it might be going.
Yeah, the biggest democracies in the world, you find India, the United States, Indonesia, Brazil. I mean, we can argue about whether the government's good or bad government, but they have free elections. And you think about it, you throw in Canada and Mexico, basically North America, you have a large chunk of the world, in some time of democratic situation, but you flip over again, you look at North Korea, you look at China, you look at Russia, look at large swaths of Africa. About half the world also is functioning in an autocratic slash military dictatorship.
Yep. Let's bring it back home, Tacky. What's going on in the Second Norfolk District these days?
It's been fairly quiet, I have to say. I mean, we've been getting more constituent calls regarding unemployment. Again, I use my constituent calls as kind of a gauge of where their economy's going and what people's needs of assistance are. Advocacy groups at a local level continue to advocate, but we're still waiting for bills to know where they are. In the second stage, so to speak, you have to come up with a joint committee. What committee are you going to be in next? So, my office is monitoring the situation, as we kind of move forward. March is kind of slowing down a bit. I mean, we have some interesting things happening in April. The Marymount Association, it's having its 100th birthday.
Yeah, how neat is that? That's amazing. Yep.
And some places are getting head start in Asian American Pacific Island Month because the Asian American Pacific Islander Commission is having their annual banquet in April as opposed to having it in May. And I just want to mention the passing. Actually, I have to look at my phone here because I won't get the name wrong if I don't look at it. But there's a bit of sadness here because we found out that May here we go. Takayanagi. May Takayanagi. May. She's Japanese descent. She's 100. She just passed away a few days of her 100th birthday, and she's one of the dwindling number of folks that basically spent quite a bit of time in Japanese internment camps.
Oh, what, here in Quincy? Does she live in Quincy?
She lives in Newton, I believe.
Oh,
I don't,
Newton. Okay.
her husband, Doc Taka, actually passed away a few years ago, and as a result of their experience, they became civil rights advocates, in the 60s, from their time in Japanese internment camp. As we talk about the greatest generation, some reason we leave out those folks that were wrongfully imprisoned.
Yeah, it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't get a lot of public discussion or exposure. What I mean, so with so much talk about reparations now, were those folks ever compensated?
They got a small amount of compensation. But that didn't occur into the mid 80s. And as I said before, the law that allows internment camps, executive orders can't be done. And the Supreme Court has still allowed the Korematsu case to be, law of the land. I mean, if the president decides to issue an executive order to inter or false, basically just imprison you based on race, they can still can if they want to. So, I mean, obviously the Japanese community in particular, faces those scars, and that part of the generation, as part of the great generation, the greatest generation, is passing on. And those advocates are, becoming less and less, and those stories that they'd be told, just like anyone from that era, on recordings and, whether you video audio recordings or transcripts, continue to be a project for scholars. And given the fact we live on the East Coast, we didn't see it in that time period. Most of it occurred in the West Coast because the largest Asian populations are in the West Coast, especially the Japanese population. And they lost everything. I talked about this already a few shows ago. They lost everything. And May here's family lost everything when the U.S. government took them and put them basically in a prison. You can call it what it is. You're in a camp and there's a barbed wire fence and soldiers won't let you out. It's prison,
Right. Yeah.
with no charges, and the civil rights were taken away. So for some reason, again, when we talk about the greatest generation, it's noticeable to me that a lot of people are left out of this conversation. Hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah. It's going to be talked about, I'm sure, for generations to come too.
We hope. I've noticed over my lifetime doing this stuff, Asian Americans, whether no matter the ethnic group, tends to be a fifth fiddle, so to speak, in the conversation of American history. So obviously I talk about, ethnic studies, laws, not just in Massachusetts, the opportunity to try to pass bills on that, but also all around the country is trying to pass bills on better ethnic studies about, people that grew up, live here, immigrated here to contribute to the growth of the country. It's largely unheard of and unspoken. And It's unfortunate because this country is built on a lot of different people from around the world, a lot of people that decided to keep and raise families here. And I'm an example of that, right? We'll see where it takes us. But yeah, no, that's kind of the sad news of the month that we got.
I'm glad you mentioned it, and thank you for doing that. On a completely different topic, something that we talked about, and actually it made the news not too long ago, is double utility poles. Tacky. I know that's your pet peeve.
Yeah, it's a bit of a pet peeve. I think it's everyone's pet peeve. Once you actually see it or live next to one, you can understand why. I mean, they're unsightly. They're a hazard, and we need to get those folks not just on the top of the power lines off, but also the bottom parts off as well. And the lack of coordination between the utility companies, the municipalities, and any third parties on there, like alarm systems, need to get themselves off those poles so those lower poles can be removed. So this is a review for everyone. If you look at a double pole, the power line is the top one. That's the one you touch, you die, as I like to put it. If that line's already on the pole next to it, the new pole, and it's not on the old pole that's double poling, then you look down next is the telecommunication lines, Verizon, Comcast, and next two down. If they're also on the new pole and not on the old pole, then you go down again, and that puts you down to the private and municipal lines, the firebox lines, the dedicated 911 lines, the alarm company lines. Any other private sector line or municipal line, and they're still there, then it's trying to get the government, municipal government, to get their stuff onto the new pole and find out who the rest of those folks on those poles need to be notified and get it off. And this gets complicated because, the electrical utility company, it's regulated by the state, so we actually have to be able to find them. But telecom companies are not regulated by the state in a conventional manner anymore. It's Telecom Act of 96 has largely deregulated them. And the FCC has regulatory control, not the state. We have very limited consumer control, but not really the amount of control in terms of influencing electric utilities. So I wish I could say just blame the electric company, but you can't. It's really a lot of different folks. And how do we incentivize people to get off those poles? And there's a central database which the utility companies put together. But it's like who's responsible, like badger the folks to get off the pole so utility can get the pole out of there.
Yep. Okay. So it's just, there's a lot of little leaders, but no one big leader in this issue.
That's correct. And do we start fining and penalizing everyone in the pole, including municipalities, to get their butt off to do it? That's a very good question. I do create a fine mechanism for the utility and an opportunity to pass those fines down the line. But it's a bit of an interesting mechanism problem of how to do that. Or we could go in and just void lease contracts because the contract utility and then set new provisions for those contracts. I mean, there's some options in my mind, but legally speaking, there's some a little bit of a legal hurdles here regarding I don't know, contractual rights of parties. So I need to think about a bit more. But I mean, I basically propose a fine mechanism and try to figure out how to get the fine mechanism cost passed on to other folks that isn't actually complying to utility or did move the lines. But I gave you guys the crash course on what to look for now. So if you have an issue regarding a double pole and you're upset, well, you can look at the lines. You can figure out where they are. And if there's nobody left but the bottom ones, well, call your city councilor in the mayor's office, obviously. And then, they can contact the utility to get rid of the pole. But if the, big lines on the top are there, then, it's really got to work your way down the, most dangerous lines first, and then you move out to the lower branch lines at the bottom.
And I think streetlights was another one you were concerned about too, along state roads.
Yeah, well, we continue to be on a DCR's case about Furnish Brook Parkway in particular, but also Queen Shore Drive. Bruce and I both have serious concerns about some of these light posts that have not been replaced, as well as the fact they're out. DCR, I'll repeat this again, 2 winters ago, told me that they're transferring the National Grid's transferring all the streetlights to DCR. We found out that it's not the case still. So I'm not happy about the fact that something was supposed to happen and never happened. And we're pointing to a few locations where National Grid owns those streetlights. So this is a problem. So, we've been bringing this to attention, and my office will have a follow-up meeting at some point down the road with DCR about, hey, is stuff getting transferred or not?
Right. Yeah. We're still watching you.
We're still on them. We're still on them. But I will point out that the Bernardi Middle School does have its new gravel substance down which will alleviate the mud slash, water, still water concerns for a bit until people picking up their kids rip that up again. And then I'll have to go back to DCR and ask for new stuff. They're still trying to work out some semi-permanent solution where the material will not degrade as quickly every time someone parks their SUV on top of it. And they're working with the school department on that issue. So I did a drive-by, did notice that the new material is down, but just to let you all know, when kids get picked up and a lot of cars roll over those curbs, eventually, it's going to get degraded again.
All righty. Anything else we should touch on today, Techie?
No, I don't have too much more this week. I'm sorry to say, folks, that it's been relatively quiet in politics, but it's another week. Well, something else may happen we can talk about.
You never know. There's always something to talk about.
Yes, we'll come up with something, whether it be local, geopolitical, national, or talk about stuff going on in our lives. We'll come up with something.
We still haven't done the Tacky Talk recipe show.
Well, I know you still have that kind of mini kitchen in the back of the studio. So
Yes.
we'll get a hot top and I'll bring some ingredients maybe, and we'll start chopping stuff up, I suppose. But that may still happen at some point. But if you'd like to see it happen, obviously contact Joe, and we'll contact the studio guys and see how that'll work. But I'm not exactly a professional cook, but obviously, all here, I do enjoy cooking, and I have a lot of dietary limitations. So as a result, it's not your conventional ingredients to try to get to the same places, like to say.
Yeah, that'd be fun. Tacky Talk kitchen talk with Tacky. All we have is a microwave and a toaster oven. So let's see what we can do with that.
I got a couple of hot tops, portable stove thingies. So, but like I said, it's I won't say it's fancy or anything like that, but I do have other parts of my life, folks, that isn't, work. Although it is my big part of my life, but I do have, I do have another life, people. It's not always just politics and stale stuff.
That's right. But for that stuff, how do they get a hold of you?
617-722-2370, 617-722-2370 is the phone number. We are staffed, room 42 of the State House. So if you're roaming the sales, you can always pop your head and say hi. And then, tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, tackey.chan at mahouse.gov. I described earlier the show how I log my calls. And State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. We continue to post stuff up there about my company's in goings and create material for Joe to talk about. And we got Tacky Chan at X, so at Tacky Chan at X. And we have Tacky Chan at ORG, as well as MALegislature.gov. I strongly encourage everyone to go to MALegislature.gov because it's a great way to watch our past hearings and sessions, but also to find bills that may be interesting to you. And obviously, check with Joe in the morning on QATV. And we'll be back every week or two to talk about whatever. And again, if you want to talk about something special, reach out to Joe.
Yep, absolutely. Be happy to hear from folks. Thanks so much, Jackie.
Take care, Joe. Thank you very much.